Welcome to Life Lab with David Ponder and Zach Schaefer. We are the podcast of Experience Experiments.
We give you those experiments via change challenges at the end of each episode.
We created this podcast because we wanted to talk about important topics that can help us all live meaningful lives.
You might agree with what we have to say, or you might disagree. But the point there is that you get something new to think about.
There's no edits and no gimmicks. Our entire point is to help you take action and live a better life.
You only get one life to live, so you may as well make the most of it. Hello, good morning, Zach.
Good morning, Dave.
How are you doing today?
It's even though it's a dreary, rainy day, I'm in a pretty darn good mood.
Yeah, I would say me too. I'm sitting here, one of the first things I did today was on the way over, I stopped by and I got a coffee. I bought something.
I see that.
I bought some coffee from a business. Somebody else made this coffee. There were some coffee beans that had to be grown. They had to be harvested, shipped. A lot went into this coffee. And then I paid a fairly small price to sit here and consume it. And that's as being one of the first acts of my day is a perfect prelude to what we're going to talk about.
Yes, it is.
We're going to talk about production and consumption.
Yes. So by consuming, by buying that Starbucks coffee and being a consumer, you allowed the end product of the production process to come to fruition.
I served the demand component of the equation.
There's an awesome old – well, it's not awesome. Most people will find it very dry. But I find it awesome. I forget the guy's name. It's Leonard's his first name. He wrote this very brief article called I, Pencil. And it's all about how the pencil came to being from the pencil's point of view. And it's about the hidden cooperation that is everywhere in a capitalist system. For that, for us to use that pencil, it goes through its journey for all these different people cooperating who've never met and will never know each other. And yet they had to cooperate for this pencil to come into existence. And the only thing bringing all those folks together is the price mechanism, which is set in the free market, set just by folks buying and selling, not by some centralized office somewhere. And anyway, it's interesting because you think the same thing with this Starbucks coffee. We just take so much for granted in life. Just the plastic top, the paper around it, the little cardboard sleeve so you don't burn your hand, and then all the coffee parts, all the people working at the Starbucks. There's tons of cooperation that we just overlook at all times, and we only focus in when it breaks down or the problems. And that's a problem because this system works really well for the most part.
And in the last year, those breakdowns have been more frequent, and I think it's made this a bigger topic of conversation. I've heard people talking about this who would never talk about this, who, you know, this is just part of the background, right? Like, I've got this life going on. This is just part of the background. It's taken for granted, right? But, I mean, at its very core, production and consumption are – you know, the economy. They're the grease that makes society.
Well, I would say yes, and that's a modern term, economy. Production and consumption is human nature.
Yeah.
Producing what I mean, the caveman era, right? Like, they were out having to produce things to keep themselves alive and stay safe and harvest food or test, have Tom over there eating certain berries to figure out which ones are poisonous or not. Like, that's a productive action.
You're right.
And why are they doing it? So that they can consume and enjoy some life and have some nice things. To me, this cuts to the heart, whether it's in a modern capitalist economy or an agrarian economy or a pre-agrarian economy, consuming and leisure and enjoyment and production and building and making things are what make us human.
Absolutely. So let's talk. Can I do a definition?
Of course. Well, you probably need two.
Yeah. So for production, the consumption one we can talk about. But for production, the one I liked was working efficiently within time to maximize output, which the key part there is output.
Yeah, output. Well, and efficiency in today's economy.
I like what you said about the – the hunter-gatherer equation.
Yeah.
Because if you think about it, nature did most of the work, but mm-hmm. still somebody had to do the productive work of doing the gathering.
Yep.
And then even somebody had the job to test it out. Tom the tester
is just out there dying, man. And it's unfortunate, but to all those folks who were the risk takers, whether it was coerced or voluntary, I don't know. But that was a real productive act to allow us to be here and know what to eat and what not to eat.
It's true.
It's all part of the cycle, man.
That knowledge, right? So it produced knowledge of what is edible and safe and what mm-hmm. is not. And that knowledge benefited billions. It might be the most productive act ever in history.
This topic could be very dry if taught from an economics class perspective. I've tried to make it very real. Well, I have made it very real for myself, but also for my kiddos. Every day I talk about, are you going to be a consumer or producer? Every day you ask my kids, what's a commercial? They're trying to sell us junk and crap and trick us into thinking we need it. Like, I want my kid to know when they're trying to be marketed to or sold, because most folks don't have a fucking clue about it, even adults, you know, and it's simple. I just think of life as a needle every day. Am I being more of a consumer today or more of a producer? And I personally feel better when I'm more of a producer, but not everybody does. There's plenty of folks who just want to consume all day long.
That's interesting.
To me, it's a very simple heuristic I personally use, and there's no quantitative metric with it. But at the end of the day, part of my daily inventory is, was I a consumer or producer today? And it's both oftentimes.
Yeah, most times. Clearly. But that being said,
and I don't mean consumer like eating food. I mean like going out and enjoying something for a few hours, you know, or making a big purchase, something like that.
Yep. Yep. And so one of the things I wanted to talk about is the psychology of productivity. What makes someone productive or want to be productive? Interestingly, I think what you touched on there is a bit of self-image.
Oh, 100%.
So like, who am I? What is my identity? I am a producer.
I go right to the funeral. We always talk about it. When I die, do I want people to be like, man, he knew how to consume. He knew how to buy stuff and just surround himself with leisurely activities. No, like he worked, man. He built cool thing. Like that's how I personally, my self-image in my head is I want people to talk about that productivity piece.
But something that I find is funny about the productivity piece, and I want your thoughts on this, is you can work hard and be very productive at different things.
Oh, yeah.
And then there's argument about whether those things are actually being productive or counterproductive. So let me give you a perfect example. The antithesis of – so when you're saying you work hard, you're being productive, I know you. You put out products that people can consume, knowledge products. You know, are constantly creating content and you're teaching people. You're doing productive things that are pretty cut and dried. They're pretty productive. It's hard to argue that they're not productive. But there are people that it's their entire job to be a critic of consumption.
Right.
Right? A wine connoisseur or a food critic or whatever. And they can work tirelessly. They can work 100 hours a week.
But what are they adding to the system?
Eating food and writing, right? Yeah. And so that, but then the question, is it productive to do that? To put down this restaurant? Like,
right.
Really? That's what you did all week? You worked 100 hours this week and it was to get every
to
detail.
To tear down an entrepreneur.
Tearing down someone who really was producing something.
That goes to my favorite quote, Teddy Roosevelt. It's not the critic. I won't read I haven't memorized, but it's not the critic who counts. You know, it's the man who gets in the arena and whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood. And I 100% believe that. It's about productivity and taking risks. And to me, the critic has no skin in the game. That's my whole critique of a critic. If that's your job, you ain't got any skin in the game. All you do is tear everything down around you and you're paid to do that. It's a bullshit job. I'd be horrified if either one of my kids wanted to become any kind of critic professionally. I'd be ashamed personally.
Wow. Yeah. Wow.
100%. Okay. I think it's a horse shit job. Now, I don't want to go tell that to a critic, but that's exactly what I believe.
Yeah. I'm a little more neutral. I think I tend toward what you're saying. On the flip side, people find value from it, obviously, and pay for it and want it. And it's a there's demand on that demand side of the equation, or else it wouldn't exist. So I think it's interesting. Yeah. But anyway, I wanted to get your opinion on it.
Yeah. No, I think it's a wasted life. How about that?
That was good. That's good. Awesome. All right.
But this lens, it's problematic because it's omnipresent. So people take the productivity lens and they apply it in areas where it shouldn't be. Am I being productive in terms of my religion or my spirituality, my fitness? Like, and they just, the economic lens really begins to eat and cannibalize all other aspects of life. And I'm not sure that that's a good thing.
Ooh, I like that.
Ooh, am I efficient as a dad today? Was I efficient? Did I get more output with my children? You know, I don't know. That's not necessarily the best lens for me to think through that.
Well, and I think it goes to show that it is omnipresent because everything has been, well, what should I say, businessified. So mm-hmm. Childcare, you can buy that.
Right.
Right? What were some of the other things? Religious stuff, religions, mm-hmm. You can buy that. And everything is marketed and sold to you to join our religion and buy our stuff and contribute to our organization. Everything is businessified. So, yeah, I can see why people get confused. There are very few things left that haven't been quote-unquote businessified, that don't cost money. I mean, you want to go see beautiful nature? You got to pay to get into the national park. And, you know, you want to go see whatever. You get what I'm saying. And
yeah.
It doesn't have to be that way, but, yeah. It's been made that way. So I can see why people get confused about that.
Yeah.
But no, I think you have a good point that they shouldn't. Like something that costs nothing, like just sitting and meditating on your own, can be something that is important. It's an important part of life that is something that should be included in your life that has nothing to do with producing or consuming. It only has to do with well-being.
With getting connected to the universe. How efficient were you in your meditation today? You know, like that's the invasion of
like, what did you get done during
the
that time?
You know, sort of that productive scientific narrative into all nooks and crannies in life. Yeah. And it's a bad thing.
Like justifying output.
Right.
Right. So that word output again, right? It's sort of the lens that we put on everything, isn't it?
What do people, again, you mentioned psychology. There's a phrase and I cannot think of it. Somebody's having a bad day and they want to go shopping to feel better. And so they call it something therapy. What do they call that? There's like a,
ooh,
you know, oh, I just need to go get a little blank therapy.
Yeah. I don't know. It's obviously,
it's like a playful pop culture term, but it's as soon as I think of it, you'll be like, oh yeah.
Consumption therapy, but I don't know.
But yeah, but that's a boy, the U.S. And we could, of course, tie in our monetary system, how it's a consumer-driven system. Retail therapy. And, God, that's a problem, I think, for folks that do that. Because, of course, it's immediate gratification. It's a high time horizon, meaning you're getting that quick boost right there to feel better about yourself. And holy shit, how fleeting is that? If you do it over and over and over, you lose your ability for delayed gratification to have that low time horizon.
So I think that's funny because what you're talking about, consumption, and what it's being driven by is the same thing that drives productivity. You know, it's emotions, personality, you know, those things drive productivity. So if you get good emotions from producing, right? So I've brought this up several times throughout our Life Lab episodes, is that there is a different podcast called Where There's Smoke that did an excellent episode on happiness where they broke it down and said they don't think happiness is something that you strive for. They think it is a byproduct of other things, one of them being productivity. And they said, if you're building a fence and you go to bed and the fence is 10 feet longer than it was when you woke up, there's something satisfying about that. It feels good. It's one of the elements that is a foundation of happiness. So the emotion that you get from something. So why you're now talking about, and this is true, there's an emotion you get from consumption.
Yeah. And I'm not saying I don't get it. I want to be clear.
Everyone does. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I go out and if I buy a new pair of shoes or something, I feel good. But that good feeling goes away. And we live in a country, in a system.
But so does it, does production?
That is, well, we'll talk about
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
Well, no, the buying is the consumption.
I know, but I'm saying I built that fence and it was 10 feet longer today. I feel good. But then tomorrow, if it ain't 10 feet longer again, I'm not going
to
feel good.
Right. So I better go buy again to feel good.
Well, so I need to go build. It's both. I better build 10 more feet of that fence today so that I can produce, so that I can feel good when I go to bed tomorrow. And sure, I need to buy some new shoes too. I need to buy something else.
Okay, I see. You're looking. Yeah. You're talking about production giving a short-term serotonin boost to make you feel good, but that's also fleeting. Yeah. Interesting, yeah. Now, I would disagree and say buying something to get a certain feeling is different than producing something, because in theory, when you've produced something, you have something. There's something that can be there and shared that you've built. Whereas when you buy something, you've just paid for something that someone else built. To me, that's very different.
Well, this is awesome. I love this conversation because you can also share that thing. So if I went out and I bought a boat and now I'm sharing it with my family, I can be continuously producing good emotion with that purchase.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is interesting because now we're getting down to economics, right? So like, what is purchasing? Purchasing is, it's exercising a debt that was owed to you when you produce something else. Like if we're talking about – that's the way that quote unquote – I don't want to get too wonky. Right. But you know, money, think about money as it's people owe you something. There is debt that is owed to you. And the way that you got that debt, stored it, was through your own production and productivity. So way back in the day before money existed, it just was held in everybody's heads, right? Zach did this thing for me the other day that was productive, that I benefited from. Now I owe him. Next time he needs a favor, right, I'm going to do that for him. He's going to come calling to me that, hey, I need you to do this. And I will. And that was the monetary system.
No, that makes sense. Okay, I agree. And I'm going to shift my thinking. I see what you're saying about the shift, the fleeting emotional high from the act of productivity. And I agree with you. That makes sense. You need to keep producing in order to keep that there. I guess the way that I might grapple with that, and I haven't ever thought of it that way, that's cool, is that at my funeral, though, if I've produced shit my whole life, that's going to sound very different when people are talking about it. Whereas if I've never produced and I just consumed my whole life.
You're right.
All people can say is, yeah, he was a lot of fun. He was fun to have around.
Dude, well, so
here. And to me, that's a good thing. I want to be that thing as well, but I also want to have built some things and done some things.
Well, and so here is where this, I think the rubber meets the road, and I've never thought about it this way either, which is, how did you get that stored debt? Did you produce to earn that stored debt to buy those things? If you did, you feel better about it.
Right.
If
somebody gave it to you.
That's exactly right. Like mm-hmm. if you all of a sudden you just had a trust fund or you just had some windfall or inheritance or something, and now you got this stored debt that other people produced. You didn't produce any of it.
Well,
and
you just no get to sweat, live off. You got no sweat, blood, and tears into that.
And you just get to cash in the fruits of their labor your whole life. And there are plenty of people that is their life.
Easy come, easy go. Yeah. Money, if it's easy to get that money, it's easy to spend that money.
And it's that you want to talk about a hollow emotion too, right? So that's one of the things that I think is the core of quote unquote the American way, right? Like the work hard at the work ethic and earn your keep and, you know, all that stuff that we were raised to do. Like I remember being raised and taught about how good work is. And like, if you're going to do a job, it's worth doing right. And there was a story my dad would always talk about his first job where he learned about the value of doing a job right. He swept some floor, right? And his boss, when he was done, he went and said, all right, boss, I'm done. What's next? And the boss said to him, what'd you do, sweep a half inch off the ground? And pointed out all the dirt, I guess, that my dad had missed. And my dad told me that story no fewer than 10 times. There's a reason why I remember it, and I'm talking about it today. Because his point was, if you're going to do something, you have to do it right, or just don't do it, right? It's not even worth doing. And that was that to me. I grew up that way, right? And I remember him talking to you about that. I mean, we used to get under a boat and scrub water off the boat to keep the boat
waxing
clean.
Cars. I remember
waxing
cars. He was real proud of me for how I waxed the car one time, and,
right.
And I'll never forget that.
Right. And so there was this work built in about that, how that is good, it is valuable. Working hard just for the sake of working hard.
Had some
intrinsic value, and that's the way that I was taught. So I think that there's something to what we're talking about when it comes to if you live a life of consumption built off of the fruits of other people's labor, the stored debt.
You can't appreciate it.
Yeah.
You can't.
You don't understand what went in to producing the things that you're consuming.
As Teddy Roosevelt said, you're not in the arena. You ain't in the arena. You don't count. You're reaping the fruit of other people's labor.
Yeah.
And that sucks. Think about kids that grew up wealthy, no fault of their own, who were given everything. Also, no fault of their own. And those parents, if the parents earned the money, I always find it so odd that many wealthy people, not all, they want to give their, we all want to give our kids a better life, which is a bullshit saying. No one even thinks through what they even mean when they say that. But the one thing that allowed them to build the wealth, the struggle, the drive, the strategy, the obstacles, they want to take all of that stuff that made their character, made them who they are, and they want to eliminate that from their children. Oh. And it's fucking, I'm just like, what are you doing? I want to throw as many obstacles at my kids as possible in a good way so they know how to navigate that stuff so that they can build their own wealth.
It's so funny because, I mean, guilty. I mean, I feel that same way. I understand the value of what you're saying, and I think that it's true as well, and I definitely want my kids. But it's funny because I'm like, but with a safety net.
I
want them to get on the high wire too, but I don't want them to die if they fall. You know what I mean? Like,
well, yeah, obviously, I don't want my kids to die. But you see, yeah. I'm not thinking about you. I'm thinking about truly wealthy people here.
Right.
Folks
right.
that have a lot of money, and it's just, and the kids grow up entitled. Mm-hmm. They just think that they have a lot, and they can't think any different. And it's no fault of their own, and then they become shitheads as adolescents and young adults.
Man. It's true, but like I think there's – so yes, 100%. There's something to be said about the lessons and the experience of what it's like to produce that gives you a gratitude for when you consume, and there's no doubt about that. What I'll say is there's also something ingrained in people and their personality, and I think this is maybe a good next thing to talk about, which is to say – why do some people have more of a natural proclivity to want to produce, and some people have more of a natural proclivity to want to consume? And I guess where I'm going with this is you've got plenty of wealthy people. I was just having this conversation. It was a question of motivation, right? As Peter says in Office Space. Well, see, it's a question of motivation. Finitech ships 10 more units. I don't see a dime. Right? So here it is. In life, it is a question of motivation. And this is one of the great arguments about should there be a social safety net? Should the government take care of people and give people some sort of basic income just to make sure everyone has a roof over their head and food to eat? And I think there's basically you get people falling into two camps. The one, people are lazy. Camp, which is no, you shouldn't do that. If you do, you're stoking the laziness fire that exists in all of us. And then you're going to have a whole society of worthless, you know, consumers that just sit on their butt and that's all they want to do is do nothing. Okay, great. And then you've got this other camp. I think I'm more in the other camp, which is no. There's a natural drive in the human condition. We have to be building and producing and creating. And I tie it back to what I said about that happiness episode. There's something about when I go to bed and I built 10 more feet of that damn fence and I feel good about it and that's innate within me. And that will never stop. It doesn't matter how much money I have. And I will point out plenty of examples of that. Why does Mark Cuban work his ass off? He's got more money than he can ever spend in his lifetime.
Screw Cuban.
Or you get what I'm saying.
Warren Buffett's 90. Yes. Munger, his partner's 95, and they can't stop. It's who they are. It's what their soul is capital accumulation, and not just for themselves, but on behalf of all the shareholders they represent.
So for everyone like that we can point out, other people can point out a guy like the dude.
Right, and they're both there. But the majority of the people, and where I consider myself, I don't think there's just two camps. I think it's like politics. There's two big camps that people gravitate to, and then there's many more nuanced ones.
I'm in the nuanced one
where it's like – I haven't thought through it all. I haven't done enough research on it because that topic, it's just a talking point topic for politicians at this point. It's not a system that's emerging on a grand scale. In some cities, they've done it. So for me, it's just a non-issue right now. When it needs to become an issue, I'll do more research and form my own opinion. But I do agree that there's going to be some people who just use it to consume more, smoke weed, whatever, buy fast food, buy bigger TVs, whatever. They'll be there no matter what. If they get free money, that's what they're doing. Buy a handle of vodka instead of a fifth. That's what I would have done in my 20s. Then there's going to be people who take that and invest. And they're going to invest in companies, maybe in crypto, maybe just do something unique. Not just save it, but invest it in somebody else who's trying to build things. Then there's going to be other people who take it and build their own business with it or do something for their own family. You know, and so I think it's a complicated discussion. And then there's another layer that even complicates it even more, and that's us being social animals. We cannot help ourselves but see what others around us are doing and ask, should I be doing that? Are they doing something that I'm not? I need to be doing that. Oh, don't do that. That guy's a moron. And it, so it ties in this level of sociality around anything we do, whether it's consuming things or producing things. People are watching whether we like it or not. So then we could talk about conspicuous consumption, which London has perfected, and now New York and LA, shit, they might have passed the torch. London might have passed the torch to them. But consuming and having nice shit nowadays isn't enough. And the media sure makes sure we keep this in front of us. You have to consume those things in front of others.
Oh, yeah.
That's the real important part.
I got to post my consumption.
And we
got to
post it.
Media.
And yeah, so we
look
do
at my beautiful new house.
We do it personally, but then the media also flips it on us all the time. But so having money isn't enough nowadays. And I'm sure it's always been that way. We just have these new tools to where we see it all the time. But you have to show it off. But then I was like, oh, yeah, I've read a lot about that. There's a really good book about London and conspicuous consumption. I'll think of the title in a second. But we do the same thing with production now. And I haven't seen anyone write about
that.
This. And what could you call it? Public production.
Conspicuous where, production.
Right, yeah. But I want a P for the alliteration. Okay. Public production. I don't know. We could think of it. But – look at what I've produced. Look at all this content I've done. LinkedIn. Just get on LinkedIn. It's about public production. So then it goes to something like what we're doing now. Is Life Lab about productivity? Should we sure like to think it is? Or is it about consumption? Or is it about both?
It's funny because I was going to, at the beginning of the episode, say, what are we doing? It's at 6:30 in the morning on a Saturday. I'm tired. Like, I wanted to sleep more, but I didn't. Why? Because I know that if I come and do Life Lab and produce another episode, it's something under my belt that I've done.
Right.
I can – my kids will – oh, they'll get to listen to this. This is something that, like you said, on the deathbed and at the end of the 100%. Balance of life.
For me, it's the inventory of life. You got to – what's your assets? What's your liabilities? For me, if I've produced these types of shows, even though it's very small, like, you know, or following small – I feel good. It all goes back to how do you feel. You want more ticks in the feel good than the feel bad.
Perceptible production. I'm going to coin that
there
term.
You go. But it's so true. But I like it because we have all these tools now, digital tools plus the internet drove it all, to where people – there's a whole producer culture, right? You've got Substack, so now they're trying to get rid of centralized legacy media because anybody can basically be their own little media company.
You got heroes. Like CEOs of productive companies, of these unicorn companies, they're here. They're celebrities now. You know what I mean? Elon Musk is a huge celebrity.
But not even names like that. Just like
– I'm even talking about like the – what's the – Adam Newman from WeWork became a celebrity.
Anthony Pompliano.
Yes.
You get on Twitter. You get enough followers. You have some power there. You can market. You can sell. So they talk about this whole producer culture, and now there's all kinds – podcasts, perfect example. It's continuing to blow up. The numbers just go up and up and up. Now there's a whole series of tools within the podcast industry. So like there's a service you can subscribe to that improves your notes that you put out with podcasts, which we don't do any of that. This is just a passion project for us. But there's something to that because it's the yin and the yang. With production, there has to be somebody interacting.
Consuming,
right?
Everyone listening to this theoretically is consuming.
It's perfect. Hollywood. You get a producer credit if you put money behind a project. Literally on the screen, it's like producer. Well, that means they put money behind this to create this. As you said, it's a notch on their belt. Oh, go to IMDb. Look at all the things this person made. That shit doesn't exist if somebody ain't out there sitting there with drool coming down their face watching it.
You're right.
They need the consumers.
You're right.
But that's where, for me personally, and my change challenge is going to be, where's your consumer producer needle? Just ask yourself, was I more of a consumer or more of a producer? And is that okay? I'm not saying you can't be a consumer. Just get, like, look at this little thing right here. I gauged from 2015 to 2020, every day of the year, was I P, B, C, or N? Was I a producer, both, a consumer, or neutral?
That's interesting.
Yeah, and it was a simple thing, but man, the years where I made the most money, dude, my producer and both numbers are off the charts.
Yeah.
When I didn't, but I had a lot of fun, my consumer numbers were off the charts.
I love how
it's just interesting.
I love how you were able to do that, you know? Like in mine, anyway.
Just the small things.
Yes.
But it's to me, okay, so, and then to me, why can I do that? Because I feel productive just doing that little activity. How weird is that?
Well,
I'm a weirdo, dude.
You are strange. No one's going to argue with that.
Well, let's talk about another strange thing. We're talking about gray areas. What about somebody that, if you're like, you're consuming right now, man? No, I'm not. I'm reading the news. I'm listening to podcasts. I'm reading articles. Nope, you're 100% consuming other people's ideas.
Oh, that's a weird idea.
That is an important idea.
It's true.
Because are you consuming that? Well, I'm reading. I'm learning. Yeah, you're consuming other people's ideas. Are you forming your own idea and then sharing it with others? That would be productive. If you're just reading others' ideas, you're consuming.
It gives you an emotion.
100%.
So it's the same thing as the consumer emotion. You said this is sort of like the new shoes. Right? But it's new ideas. Oh, I never thought about
that. Ooh, I can talk about this. I can talk about cancel culture. I have a talking point to say now.
You know what? I'll say this. Producing this, when I go back and listen to our episodes and consume them, I'm like, damn, I like.
That's cool.
But it's I wonder how much of it is like, yeah, but it's because self-reinforcement. Those were our ideas that we share. So of course I'm going to like hearing them back to me. But that being said, it's funny how consumption of ideas stokes good emotions, because we were talking about what goes into productivity, right? Personality, emotion, yada, yada. I think they're two sides of the same coin.
Well, they are.
Productivity and consumption. And I'm coming to this conclusion. This is not something I've thought in the past, because it's the same thing. Personality drives them. Emotions drive them. You get good emotion from consuming, and then it reinforces that consumption, and you want to do it again or more or whatever.
Yeah. Well, they are two sides of the same coin. That's why I said yin and yang earlier. A great example. I still do love Family Guy. I just haven't watched it in a long time. Whether you like those kinds of shows or not are unimportant. But the creator, Seth MacFarlane, a pretty creative guy, a bit of a unicorn. So when they first launched the show, it was his idea. He helped sketch out the whole first pilot. He did all the voices for all the characters. He put his own money behind it, and he got it launched. You know, and fast forward, they've been around like 25 years now, a long time. He was the first $100 million television writer of all time. Why do I say all this? Well, at some point when they're just racking these things out, and he's making singing CDs and, you know, doing all the crap that these producers do, he had a total physical and mental breakdown where he almost died. He was in the hospital for a while. And he's like, I was literally working like 18 hours a day, 7 days a week, just nothing. And he's like, and I was just cranking, man, producing, just producing. And he's like, and it literally almost killed me. I almost worked myself into the grave making a fucking cartoon, he said. And he cusses a lot. And when he got out of that, everything on Family Guy changed. Meetings, he's like, when I'm ready for the meeting, I show up. And he's like, and it sucks because people have to sit around and wait. He's like, but I'm not going to kill myself for this. And I thought that was really interesting. Like, and we all know people, and maybe you are that person. You can produce yourself into the grave. I think my grandfather, my dad's dad did that, worked so hard and gave himself so much stress. He had a heart attack at 59. I know plenty of people in our circle. They're putting a lot of wrinkles on their face right now, man. Grinding it to the grindstone, probably taking years off their life that we're not aware of.
Dude, this is such a good I love where you're going with this.
Yeah.
So two things I want to say about this. Quickly, I want to – because there was a transition part that I don't want to miss. There was an opportunity. I don't want to miss the opportunity to tie conspicuous consumption with ideas and media. What are you watching now, man? Oh, like, what are you reading? What are the things? What are the ideas that you consume? Because, my God, you want to talk about one of the most socially acceptable areas of conspicuous consumption?
What shows are you watching?
You're at a party, if you're watching the same thing other people are watching, and oh man, you become popular. Yeah. Like you get social capital,
right? You social, 100%. Your status, it's all status. Your status goes up,
right?
And then if you're not watching the same thing as your friends, you feel like your status goes down. You're missing out. FOMO.
And you're watching, I don't know,
Yellowstone. Crown? Yellowstone.
You're watching Yellowstone too? Yeah. Oh, yeah. And you drive an Audi? I drive an Audi. Wow.
You have a big green egg? Yeah. I have a big green egg.
We have all these things that we're similar on, right?
Yeah. But I like it because at least they're looking at commonalities and some cohesiveness.
Yeah. I'm not necessarily trying to say it's all a bad thing.
Right.
I'm trying to say it's so interesting.
We connect over our consumerism.
Yes. And we make consumption of ideas conspicuous. Like I like to watch this and I fall in line with these ideas and yada yada yada, you know?
But now let's go the other way, because that can come off condescending. I know you're not making it that way, but it can't, when we talk about it, it feels very superficial.
Mm-hmm.
But we all do it.
Mm-hmm.
I go to my dinner clubs, the first thing people talk about, the first fucking thing, what do you watch?
Like, yeah,
you seen? they're not book folks, and that's okay. I have other book folks,
right?
And if I bring up all the books I'm reading, I come off like an asshole, or at least I feel like I do. Because I know they don't read them. So then it's just like, oh, he reads more than we do. He thinks he's better than us. Mm. That's how I feel. I don't know if they'd actually think that. But I'm like, I know they don't read books. So why would I bring up all this shit I'm reading?
Yeah, that's all valid. Yeah,
but to me, it's because of the conspicuous consumption. But let's flip it. The business side. So you share and, oh, you got the new shoe. What are those? Cool. Then you go to the party and you see the two guys or the two gals in the corner. Yeah, we got this new loan. The bank's trying to screw me at 3.5%. I know that I could get LIBOR minus one prime, but the guy's an asshole. Who's your banker, right? And so you know those conversations, yeah, they're going on. It's a little bit public, maybe a little bit of conspicuous. What are they doing? They're enhancing their emotions and connecting over being producers.
Yes, absolutely.
It's the same thing. Yeah. It's a driving the emotions.
Because you're opening that new division. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you're going to, you know, right, expand business. But you said you were going to do a 20% growth this year.
Well, now
we're
training the trainers. So three of my team members got the certification to train the trainers.
Oh, man, that's great. Anyway, yeah, that's hilarious. You're right. It is. It's perceptive production.
But then for self-aware folks,
or perceptible
conscientious folks, because there's plenty of people who aren't self-aware and aren't conscientious, and they'll just dive into these conversations in a social setting and be totally fucking clueless that other people are just sick of hearing it or don't want to hear. So you got to know how to navigate those conversations in a social setting to drive those emotions you're going for without coming off looking like a, hey, everyone, look at me, I'm doing great or whatever.
Which is hard. It is so hard.
Because then you got virtue signaling going on, which is all status enhancement.
Here's something I'll say. That this is just a personal conversation you and I can have publicly. That others can listen. One of the things I've been having
– everyone can listen.
I've been having a hard time dealing with this in social settings as I've gotten more and more into stoicism, right? And the idea that this ain't – like I don't want to pump myself up and like I want to have less of an ego and like, yeah, this isn't about me. So I'm like trying to take that into these situations. And in those situations, I'm downplaying.
Well, you're not just downplaying. You almost don't talk about it at all. I'm going to pat you on the back because you're applying a stoic philosophy, which is about that. And that's hard because that – stoicism bumps up against everything that modern day capitalism stands for. More, 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 me, me, me.
Right.
You know? And
yeah.
Stoicism would say ignore the consumption side, focus on being productive and useful and valuable. But what I would say for you is you downplay it too much, man. Like you're doing good. You're doing neat stuff. You're scaling a business. I think where the rub is it's in a really complex, nuanced field that's hard for somebody to begin to understand.
Yeah.
So maybe if you can get a couple lines you could develop a few political high-level talking points about what's going on, because people would want to hear and they'd be proud and be happy to be your friend because you're building it. But if you give no details
– maybe that's part of what's led me down this road. Is like, and I'll say, oh no, it's all the stoicism. It's all me doing the stoicism. But no,
I'm just a stoic.
Maybe it's also, yeah, no, you're kind of calling me out and I like it. Or you're making me call myself out. Maybe it's part of the thing where it's like people don't understand it. And so it's hard to explain anyway. So it's not like I get a really great positive emotion out of people. I usually get blank stares. Even when I'll start to go down the road with one of our guy friends who has their own business, you know what I mean? And then I'm like, I have to give so much background information.
Well, that's because you
end up being like just staring like with a blank stare.
Because you're analytical.
Yeah, right.
You take them to a level they don't need to be at. Just be a politician. Give yourself 5 talking points that you can go out on the campaign trail and people get excited about, and that's it.
But
that's not who you are.
But I don't want to do that.
Well, then don't.
Yeah.
You know, but that would be how you could do it. Yeah. But you got to put thought behind what those messages are, how they sound, and all that shit, you know. But now we're talking about production of who we are, a production of our identities, the identity production process.
And this all rooted from when we were talking about conspicuous consumption and perceptible production, because what you're doing is you're saying, this is who I am, right? Like, I kind of touched on it for half a second, right? I'm a BMW driver who is,
I live in a lawyer. Yeah,
and
who lives in Webster.
Yeah, exactly.
Does whatever.
You build your identity and likes to watch Curb Your Enthusiasm. Like, that's who I am. You know what I mean? And then you go to a party and it's just bumping up of identity politics.
It's Facebook profiles just bumping against each other. And then the algorithm will predict, I bet you'd have a good conversation with them because you consume the same things.
Exactly. Exactly. Oh, man, all right, you're giving me a good change challenge. And this is a weird one to come out of this. We're talking about production and consumption, right? Here's a change challenge that I'm going to challenge myself with is the next time I'm in a social setting, and I actually think I've done this a few times lately and I didn't really know why, but I will put it upon myself to at least make small talk with someone that I have nothing in common with. They're not watching the same stuff that I'm watching. We don't drive the same car. None of that. Right? Like, it's uncomfortable. It's hard, right?
You just don't feel like there's no superficial things that you can quickly connect to.
Exactly.
Oh, the weather nowadays.
Yeah. And that's the thing is, like, it's hard and it's uncomfortable. But in life, anything that's hard and uncomfortable is worthwhile.
We got a neighbor right across the street. Kizzy and I were just talking. Just awkward, man. And she will not talk. And the husband will, and he's cool. But it's getting more than a high out of her. I just look at it as a challenge to see like how much info I can get out of her. And it's funny because I can tell she doesn't want to talk, but I'm pretty good at doing that. And so, but yeah, man, there's just certain folks who that's just not who they are.
Yeah,
they're much more comfortable behind a screen and can be very extroverted online through a mediated communication. But face to face, a lot of people just lock up.
See, that's interesting because so do people like that. If we're talking about building an identity and doing signaling of production or consumption, right? They don't do any of that. They just kind of like put up a curtain.
Well, in person, but online, we can have a whole other identity. So that online, they could maybe have a lot of identities. They could have multiple identities online.
So a person like that, right? So we're talking about drives, motivations for both the consumer and producer side of the house. Do you think that they still like to have it as a part of their identity, that it still builds them up? They just don't get the feedback in the way that we do. Like, we want the direct feedback. We want to talk to people about it.
We want to talk our ideas into existence.
We want to see what they think about it.
They think their ideas into existence, if we're talking about extroversion specifically.
I guess what I'm saying is I'm sure there's plenty of introverted people who go and drive – fancy cars because of the fancy badge, because they want other people to
look
think.
Look at Silicon Valley, dude. It's full of introverts. The needle of extroverts ruling the world is quickly shifting to introverts ruling the world, who are analytical, software-focused folks. And you go to Silicon Valley, they sure as shit are about, I got money, look at what I'm wearing. And they're obviously analytical, introverted folks.
So they just get – they want the bolster for the – signaling of their production and the signaling of their consumption indirectly.
See what I got? I ain't going to talk to you about it, but I got it.
I like it.
Funny.
Yeah. I know that you're impressed.
Right.
I know. I can just know tell that
you're impressed.
I know. I watch TV. I see it through all these other channels of media. This is what people are impressed by, and I've got it, and I do it. Yeah.
Consumer identity is a fabric of the United States, and I'm sure it is of other Western countries that are capitalistic. But being a consumer is embedded, and we see that literally Americana gets interwoven to being a consumer. So now on the celebration days when we're supposed to be truly paying homage and being grateful and thankful for folks who have died in wars, in conflicts, so that I can enjoy freedom and do things, we've turned that into sales. That's an opportunity to go buy. Think about that. If those folks, those men and women who are dying, it's like, hey, you're doing this so that people can go buy more shit. That's what they're thinking about.
Yeah,
that's just weird. I don't know if that's good or bad. It's just, but boy, that's American.
We sell more mattresses
on Veterans Day or on Memorial Day. Or, but the day, these honorable days where we're supposed to honor our dead, people that have done ultimate acts of sacrifice that they fought for with their life, and we now consume on their behalf with very little reverence, moments of silence, just rituals around the house, and I'm putting my family in there. That to me is not a good thing.
Yeah, it's interesting. And as we go down this road, right, like consumerism baked into the fabric of human society, I think about how, yes, and even with that idea, even with that notion, for me, there is a nostalgic consumerism that is better than today's consumerism. So let me explain myself. Today, you know, there are so many different choices and brands and whatever that you don't – it's hard to find someone that you connect with. You said, I've got a Big Green Egg. I've got a Big Green Egg, right? How many people out of the total have Big Green Eggs? Not many. Why? Because there's so many. You could have a Traeger. You could have a Weber. You could have a – you get what I'm saying. Like just the way that the U.S. economy has evolved to the point today, it almost is – more, you know, it creates more divisions between people and less chance to connect. Where you know, you look at like Norman Rockwell paintings, right? Or what's the other?
That's a good one.
And you see brands in these paintings that everyone shared. Like it was like a communal experience. Like everybody, you know, used that. Everybody ate that. Everybody, whatever. And so as consumers, they had more of a communal consumer experience than we have today. So yes, it is the fabric of U.S. society, of all Western and advanced societies. There's a consumeristic piece of it. We've been exploring all of the different pieces of that consumeristic experience, and they don't just include products and services. They include ideas too. Mm-hmm. I feel like as time has gone on and we've got diversity, the great diversity that everybody, you know, wants more and more of. It's also had more division because of it.
Well, with every choice, you're going to unite some and divide others. Every choice we make as humans, no matter what. There is no universal choice that unites all.
But if there's two choices, you're dividing 50% and you're uniting 50%, right? But if there's three, you're only uniting 33%.
And it keeps going.
And you're dividing 66%.
Just walk into a cereal aisle.
Yeah, there you go.
I mean, that's the most visual metaphor. It's overwhelming. It's totally overwhelming. It's ridiculous.
And our consumption and production free market has produced, well, there's enough demand that we got to put out the chocolate Lucky Charms version because the regular Lucky Charms version, you know, it'll sell, but we can bump it by
3%. Yeah, they'll stop selling it when people don't buy it. So it amazes me that people are buying that nuanced of cereal. I need the Lucky Charms with the extra pots of gold marshmallows. What the fuck is wrong with
people? They discontinue it. People get pissed.
It's nuts.
Hey, bring it back. We want a campaign. Well, let's start an online
marketing,
campaign.
Man. That's the beauty of marketing. It creates a brand. I view a brand as an emotional attachment to a product or a service. And really skilled marketers are very good at creating those emotional attachments. Brands are nothing but somebody recognizes something and has a feeling tied to that thing.
Yeah, emotion, like we said.
That's weird.
Yeah. And it's a uniting versus dividing thing for brands. Like, oh, I'm a Coke guy, man. Like,
right.
You know what I mean? Like, what are you? You a Coke guy? You like Coke? You like Pepsi? What is it?
Yeah.
What are you? It's the identity. It's that uniting versus dividing. It's so interesting. You know, we've gone in this episode. I don't know how far we are. Pretty far.
We're at 48 minutes.
We haven't even touched on a ton of the stuff that I thought we were going to touch on, right? So we were just dancing around supply and demand there.
Yeah.
So we talked about demand, justifying production of niche products, right? And that's the same thing with services. And the whole economics that drive that is something that when we started talking of this and doing like our preparation, I was pretty sure we were going to get into like the workings of economics, because ultimately that's what we touched on, money and it being stored debt. And I liked the way that we did that, right? And now we're just dancing around supply and demand. But I think there's we're running out of time, but you can't leave it out. When we're talking about consuming and producing, you wouldn't be producing something if there wasn't a demand for people to consume it. Or if you did, it wouldn't be. It's funny. It's not really considered production then. It's just a hobby.
No, I agree. Mostly I agree, but there's an asterisk.
Okay.
Most businesses are not creating something new. They're iterating on things that already exist. Peter Thiel's book, From Zero to One, there's absolutely people that bring things that didn't exist, and you create the demand by bringing it into existence. That's the Musks of the world. That's the Steve Jobs. He said, people don't know what they want until I build it for them. That he created demand. If you know, it's the same. Henry Ford said, if I had asked people what they want, they would have said a faster horse. That's very different. They create demand by producing this new product that's, again, that's more
it's
rare.
It's one of a kind. It's the first of its kind.
People just – they don't know that they want it because they've never seen it. They don't have the creative capacity to even envision something that different, going from horses to cars on a mass scale. What? I just need a faster horse. Yeah.
The best one of those that I can think of recently is the smartphone, right?
100%.
Yeah.
But that to me is different than what you're talking about.
It is.
Because they build the demand by building the product.
It is, and there's all like everything, there's nuance even to that, because you could talk about the smartphone and how it's a rare event when a product comes out that is not an iteration of something else.
Right.
I don't know why, but that's the case. On the flip side, well, I guess I was going to say art and music are their own, and they are. But they are also iterations of something else. 100%. Now that I'm talking through it, because I was going to say, like, well, I make a song, and there's that song is its own thing. It's the only song that is like that ever produced, and so there's some originality to it. And then the question becomes, yeah, but with art, it's funny because demand is a tricky thing in the art and music realm. They're so subjective. What is good and what is not, does it catch on?
Right? Is there a story behind it that people care about?
Is there a story that people care about, and then the opinion of it, that opinion proliferated through enough of the society that enough people have then decided, okay, yes, that thing is good, I want it, and now it has value, mm-hmm. right? And now it was a worthy production versus somebody who just paints all the time because they like to paint and it's a hobby. And think about how many artists have done that and produced and produced and produced and never, there was never any demand. It never really became, versus every once in a while one hits, you know, this Beeple guy.
Yeah.
He was a graphic designer in Ohio, created some
art. The First 5,000 Days is the name of it.
Yeah, okay. And it's art, and the thing that made it new and unique is it's probably the most famous example of a NFT, mm-hmm. non-fungible token. And so if you don't know what that is, look it up. We can't get into that. But it sold for how much?
$69.3 million. It's the third highest payment for any living artist's art of all time.
So supply and demand is so egregious in that example. There's only one of them, and it's a cool new thing that society right. all wants, these NFTs, and this is – everyone agreed. This is it. This is the best one of these NFTs, so it's worth
– right, because of scarcity.
$63 million.
Scarcity.
So think about – oh, and then let's tie that back, and I don't want to – I'm sorry.
No,
I'm
you're
hijacking
good.
This. But let's tie that back to stored debt. Imagine with that little bit of work that he did to make that piece of art, the sheer amount of stored debt that he earned. He never has to work a day in his life, and he might even be able to have generations of consumers.
So I'll he exhibited grit. I mean, you know, he created every day for 5,000 days in a row
a pretty nuanced piece of digital graphical art. Like if you look at his painting, it's crazy looking, but when you zoom in, it's all these little pixels are specific 5,000 different images. So like, I don't know how long it took him, but it's not like it's a color. It's not like Jackson Pollock here where it took him hours every day for 5,000 days in a row. Now, is that worth $69 million? How long is a piece of string? People said, yeah, it has value. People have money because of the macroeconomic environment. They need to store it somewhere. So yeah, boom, his life's changed.
That's awesome.
But to me, that to me is also a kind of a 0-to-1 thing. This whole NFT thing, it's like a totally new way to think about storing value and creating in new ways. And people get excited about that stuff.
I love it because it's a really unique example that is very illustrative of what we're talking about. We're talking about producing. We're talking about consuming. Supply, demand, money, so stored debt, people owing you something for past productivity of yours or someone else's, who knows. In that one example, you hit all those dynamics in such extreme ways that it makes it like really visible.
Well, one other thing we didn't talk about, you said economics, is just the financialization of the world.
We talk, yeah, let's touch on that.
Well, I mean, just they're not producing anything. You know, they're making everything about money and finding more nuanced ways to extract money from different systems or make money off of other money in ways that weren't made before, but they're not building anything. And this just isn't my idea. Lots of folks out there believe that that's a problem. And there's too many people going into finance and getting MBAs, Elon Musk included. He says, we need more builders. We need more engineers. We need more people out there bringing things into the world that solve problems that we have and benefit humanity, not just people who know how to move money around or make money off of loans in creative new ways that we hadn't thought of before. And think of how many really smart minds there are in finance. So tons, millions. And if their minds could be out building, I personally think that'd be better.
I agree with you. On the flip side, you wouldn't make money without demand. And so there is demand out there. Like I'd say an egregious example of that, where that becomes a problem, I've used that word too many times in this episode, where that becomes a problem is when you have artificial demand, artificially created demand that was, you know, put there by some institution or government because they've decided that it's going to benefit society. If we're just talking about capitalism, right? Like, yes, it would be better if more people were manufacturing, right? But we've gutted our manufacturing in the U.S. because we've decided the economy would be better if we move on to higher things like goods and services and consulting and software and all the, you know, stuff that we're talking about not being as good as creating tangible things.
Own the IP.
But we can trade with another country.
Let other people own the capital assets.
They can do that stuff. And it just goes into, yeah, well, it's gotten so complex. This thing has gotten so complex that what people are incentivized to do. And maybe this goes into the feeling part. Maybe this goes into depression as a society. Maybe this is one of those nuanced elements that we never talk about. But, you know, the Western cultures are unhappy and depression is like at the highest levels it's ever been. If you think about it, if I truly believe production is a component of happiness, which I do, you're going to feel better about yourself if you're producing some tangible good. You just are. You can hold it. You can feel it. You can see it. You know someone's going to use it. It's really easy for my brain to make a connection there.
Yeah, it's the reptile brain can wrap its – get around that more easily.
Versus, I don't know, I'm giving some consulting service.
Yeah, I'm offering consulting advice to somebody they may or may not take, but I'm getting paid either way.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what you're – in modern Western societies that have quote-unquote advanced economies, you are incentivized to do the latter and not the former. You are not incentivized to create and build some tangible thing because you don't make money that way. No one gets paid a bunch of money for building individual products and whatever. Some people do it. It's you know, definitely.
It's a capital-intensive industry
to
go into manufacturing.
Yeah, and it has shifted away because of economic forces. Location of the places to do it and labor and all this stuff have shifted away. It is You are disincentivized to doing that. And we've seen depression go up. I wonder if, you know, like.
Well, that's the funniest part of all this. Yeah. We can consume more and more than any. The average middle class person in the United States lives better than the ancient kings. That's crazy.
That's crazy.
We can travel. We can fly to anywhere. Again, an average middle class person can take some fairly exotic trips, or at least more exotic trips than kings and queens of the ancient world.
Food.
Daily. You can eat food from anywhere in the world.
Yeah.
So we can really, we can put on a TV and create all kinds of different feelings. We can get in-person experiences, music festivals, sports, all this stuff. So we can consume at our fingertips, within arm's reach. And we can produce. We have all these new opportunities to become producers and create content on our own. Basically, become your own mini little business. Create your own demand for your ideas or your products. And yet, with all of these opportunities on both sides of the scale, depression and suicide is through the roof still. These things don't make us happy. Neither one.
I agree. Ultimately, I agree.
So that's the craziest part.
Yeah.
The happiness is internal. It ain't external. And whether the external's consuming or the external's producing, the happiness is internal. And yeah. That's tough.
Yeah, I think we did hit on something with the, you said, you know, the reptile brain not being able to tie back to. I do think complexity is a problem, right? So it's not that we're not producing and it's not that we're not consuming, but we did hit on some things that I think talk to the complexity that things have, to the level of complexity that things have gotten and the degrees of separation between us and our production and our consumption. To me, and I'll end with this thought. To me, if I'm going to produce, there's something about concrete production and the joy that you get out of seeing others consume what you have produced. And on the flip side, there's something about communal consumption, connecting with people when
breaking
we consume.
Bread specifically.
Breaking bread. That's a perfect example.
I've always talked to my cousin, or I used to, about he's a builder. In construction, and I view myself at a conceptual degree to try to be a builder of human relationships. His is just so much more tangible, and it's more clear cut. It's complicated but not complex, whereas human relationships are complex and complicated, and we revert to previous behaviors. It's hard to change. But man, like the joy he got out of building a deck or pointing at a house, being like, I built that. That's one thing is I can't, in my line of work, point to something and just be like, you know, that's me. There's my thumbprint. And that's hard. So that's why I do all these outside things to try to be an agent of change and develop lasting things like LifeLab. That to me is just interesting. There's really something to the tangible nature of things. And as I get older, I try to find hobbies for myself personally where I can see the fruits of my productive labor. So that's why I like LifeLab. Nobody can take away that, you know, we're going to be at 100 episodes soon, and that I've done that for my kids so that when I'm dead, they can go back and listen to this and see how insane their dad was.
And I get some crazy positive emotions whenever someone goes, I was just listening to the episode on whatever.
Yeah, yeah, it's a positive thing.
And then they strike up a conversation with me about it, and I'm like, oh.
Yeah, I don't need to be Joe Rogan.
No.
Like, this is just fun for me to talk about these things.
It's one of the best feelings that I get, really. And
nice.
Yeah, and I'm tying it back just to close the loop of what you're saying. I'm sure when your cousin sees someone in the house that they built, knows that the family is growing up there, and they built that home that is enabling that, that's got to be a great feeling.
Oh, great feeling. Yeah, it's a working – there's something to working with your hands and building something that you can see, or working with your brain to software engineering, being like, I built this software. Like, there's something cool to that.
I think that's a perfect place to close this is to say we talked about production and consumption being important and being a thread that runs through daily life, whether you want it to or not, and being a part of that builds your identity and all of these things. I like what we just ended on, right? A lot of times in LifeLab, we end up with connection, human connection, because it's such an important thing. And to think that we are now closing this episode by tying production and consumption to human connection is awesome. That's so cool to me to think that we've gotten there. through the things that we've talked about. And I think that might be one of the important things that as I carry the lessons from this episode forward, I'm going to remember that when I produce in the future, it will probably be more fulfilling and satisfying if I'm able to produce things that I'm able to create a human connection with.
Yeah.
And vice versa. When I consume, I'm going to try to choose, because you choose what you consume.
Well, yeah, we don't need to argue.
Right.
I agree.
Most even if it's just food.
And, I'm saying that most people get up and they're not choosing because the choice is already made because they've built a habit. So with a choice, you see paths. Most people don't see paths from the day time they wake up. They're just doing. And it's because they've built a very clear habit around their consumption choices. So there ain't no choice there.
I'm coining all kinds of new terms on this episode. I'm going to coin the term conscientious consumption.
There you go. Conscientious consumption. I like that. That's good.
So you choose. So choosing what I consume purposely with the express intent of building human connection around it. Communal consumption.
Nice. I'm going to break my rule in life. When you're doing public speaking endeavors, you should never add a new point that hasn't been discussed towards the end in the conclusions. So I'm going to break that. When you're with people you love, it's parenting mostly. If you're with your family, how I think of it, and I'm not saying you have to, but you can if you find it useful. When I'm consuming with my family and creating memories and trying to be in the moment and create joy, I'm also being productive. I'm trying to help instill a lesson with my kids all the time, or help them to think about production, or adding some kind of question to them during that process. And that's just my mental way of saying, okay, even though I'm being a consumer right now, I can still be producing things. And that is trying to build kids with character, trying to be a responsible dad, and trying to be a good dad. So to me, that's, I blur it. Other people could argue against, no, that's not really production, but I feel it is. And that's all that matters, is that feeling you're going for. So my change, or in a nutshell, we've talked about a lot. We hit high level on some economic stuff, but I'm glad we didn't do a deep dive on that. We made it more concrete, I think, by talking about the things we did with the human connection, thinking about consumption and production as two sides of the same coin, or really more of a sliding scale or a continuum. And so my challenge is for you to think about on a daily basis, if you were being judged every day, would you say I was more of a consumer today or more of a producer? Just keep it simple. 51%, which one were you? Or both. So that's one of my change challenges.
Yeah, I like it.
What's yours?
What was the one I gave earlier? I gave one earlier that was completely...
Dave, I'm not in the business of remembering your change challenges.
Yeah, that's a good one. That's a good one. Okay, so then the one I'll give here at the end is about tying your production and your consumption to human connection. And just intentionally do so. So the next time that you go to produce something, or the next time you make a choice about what you're going to do, consider the degrees of separation between what it is you're producing and the person who's going to consume it, and see if you can lower those degrees of separation. Produce something that can be consumed by someone that you can either experience them consuming it, or you can even consume it with them. And that's easy when you think about things like cooking a meal, or even, you know, growing a garden and then cooking
You mentioned grilling. So for me, I view grilling as a productive act for me personally.
Yeah.
Most people would be like, no, it's consumptive. Yeah, we're consuming the end product, but to me, I feel like I'm producing something.
Especially if you share it with others.
Well, sharing it with others and then just getting the kids out there, teaching them about the grill. You know?
Right.
Anyway.
Right.
Well, hopefully you've had fun on this one. We got a lot of energy from it. I think you heard it. We ended up going 1:07, which is a lot long for us. But as we say at Life Lab, experiment with life.